Welcome, dear patrons. This episode is produced by you, and you make Registry Matters possible. Thank you for being part of our community. And always remember, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 372 of Registry Matters. Good evening, sir. How are you?
Doing awesome. How are you?
I'm all right, man. We have now started with like summer weather and you got to like make your grass look pretty and all that. Why can't we just have rock yards, right?
Well, you could, but your neighbors might not like them there the way they do here.
Is that a problem over there?
Well, it's
Do people
encouraged.
Get pissed off with a rock? Well, you guys have water problems all the time.
It's encouraged. They give you an incentive to use desert landscaping here.
So do you have any cacti in your front yard?
I don't, but some people do. That's a part of the desert landscaping.
Of course it is. All right, well, please remember to show your support by hitting like and subscribe and do the five-star review thing. Of course, you could lie and you could give us a five-star review even if you hated the program, and that would help us out, and I would appreciate it. Should we tell people to do that, Larry?
We should tell people to do that because FYP is going broke.
Oh, I didn't realize this. All right. And then if you would be so very kind, you could head over to patreon.com/registrymatters and join our community. And then you can do all kinds of fun things in the Discord server, like hang out with the deputy and learn about graphics cards. Right?
About what?
GPUs. We talked about that pre-show. You don't remember?
I heard GPU, but I didn't know it was graphics card.
It's a graphics processing unit. All right, well, what are we doing tonight?
Well, this should be a fun and enjoyable episode because I'm going to be interviewing you about the $375 million verdict handed down against Meta here in New Mexico. And we have a case from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals that is an amazing win for the PFR population. Not so much it's going to change the trajectory of registration, but in my view, it will send a message to law enforcement at some level that you ought not be playing games.
Well, very good. Let's start with this Meta hit with $375 million verdict out of New Mexico. And so the jury just handed this down. This was roughly a couple weeks ago, wasn't it?
Yes.
All right, and for those of you that don't know, Meta is the parent company of Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, and the headlines are screaming about this 375 penalty. Now, you've been chomping at the bit to get into the legal side of this, and so let's set the table. What happened?
Well, I can tell you a little bit, but not much. So the case is New Mexico versus Meta Platforms, and the case number is available if you need to know. It was filed in First District. New Mexico District Court in Santa Fe. It was brought by Attorney General Raul Torres back in December 2023. The legal basis is New Mexico's Unfair Practices Act. And again, the citations for that act are available. The state alleged two things. First, that Meta made false or misleading statements about the safety of its platforms, which falls under the definition of an unfair or deceptive trade practice. And second, that Meta engaged in unconscionable trade practices defined in the relevant section of New Mexico statutes, which means conduct that takes advantage of a person's lack of knowledge, ability, or experience, a grossly unfair degree. Both of these are prohibited under Section 57-12-3 New Mexico statutes annotated.
So who brought the enforcement action? This wasn't a class action, one of your favorite things. This wasn't a class action suit by the plaintiffs?
No, it was brought by the Attorney General under the Attorney General's enforcement authority under Section 57-12-8, which allows the Attorney General to bring an action in the name of the state when he or she has reasonable belief that someone is engaging in practices declared unlawful by the act. And the penalty provision is in that Section 57-12-11 New Mexico statutes annotated, which allows a civil penalty up to $5,000 per violation when the conduct is found to be willful. And that's apparently where the $375 million comes from.
I guess we could have one of our listeners do that math real quick. What's 5,000 divided into 375 million to know how many counts they got hit with? Now, so this wasn't some kind of crazy abstract theory. This actually, the government ran an undercover operation, I guess, almost like a sting.
That's the rumor. The Attorney General's office created fake social media profiles posing as 13-year-old children. According to the original complaint, these accounts were flooded with sexually explicit content and solicitations from adults. That investigation led to actual arrest, three of them. So when this went to trial, the state wasn't having waving around hypotheticals. They had receipts. The trial ran for about 7 weeks in Santa Fe before a judge that I cannot begin to pronounce.
I think it's Biedscheid. B-I-E-D-S-C-H-I-E-I-D. Sorry. I think it's Biedscheid, but that sounds almost too rhythmic for that. And I thought it was really interesting. So the jury came back super fast. They came back in 1 day of deliberations. It seems to me that feels unusual that it would be that fast.
It felt that way to me as well. 1 day, but they found Meta liable on both counts. And that's important. They found the conduct was willful, which triggers the $5,000 per violation maximum under the statute. The statute defines willfully as intentionally, as the intentional doing of an act with knowledge that harm may result. The jury applied the penalty to approximately 37,500 users, which according to the source, to Source New Mexico's reporting, accounts for roughly one quarter of New Mexico's teen population based on the most recent census data. That's how you get to 375 million.
I see. Okay, so 37,500 times 5,000 is 375 million. All right, so let's put this in perspective, because $375 million sounds like a fortune. I mean, you know, FYP's coffers has roughly that amount of money in. However, for Meta, reported $160 billion in revenue last year. So this isn't really even like a rounding error. This is just like, oh, hey, look, there's a penny on the floor. This is kind of like that to them.
It's less than a single day's revenue, and they've already stated that they intend to appeal. Meta spokesperson said they respectfully disagree with the verdict. Imagine that.
So now, before we get too much into the real meat of this, I feel like you have some opinions about New Mexico and big business. And also I want to talk about possibly making a comparison with this in the tobacco industry. There was something called the Master Settlement Agreement back in the day, because the news coverage is drawing a direct line between this case and big tobacco.
Well, having lived here for, I'm in my fifth decade, I've watched how the people think here, and New Mexico has a bit of a reputation for being hostile to large corporate defendants and even wealthy individuals. And it's not entirely undeserved. This is a state that gave us Liebeck versus McDonald's restaurants, probably the most famous product liability case in American history. That was the hot coffee case from 1994, tried here in Bernalillo County. A jury found McDonald's liable for initially awarded $2.7 million in punitive damages. And I mean, that would they would want their coffee hot, right?
You would think. So, and to be fair, a lot of people don't know the facts around that case. So that woman, Stella Liebeck, which did you pronounce it as?
I said Liebeck, but it could go either way.
Sure. So Liebeck, and she was 79 years old, so one of your contemporaries. She suffered third-degree burns in her pelvic region. She needed skin grafts. The coffee was being served. It was being served at 180 to 190 degrees Fahrenheit. Like, my God. The McDonald's had over 700 prior burn complaints on file, and they didn't change anything. She initially asked for $20,000 to cover her medical bills. McDonald's offered her a whopping $800.
So, well, to be fair, I don't know the inner workings of McDonald's, but most of more of them are franchise operations. So when you talk about McDonald's as a company, who would have been the responsible party? That's a show for topic for another day. But if a guy owns two McDonald's stores, they don't have that kind of money. I mean, they have $800, $20,000, but they don't have hundreds of millions of dollars. But anyway, the trial judge called McDonald's conduct willful, wanton, and reckless. But the media turned it into a lady spills coffee and gets millions, and it became a poster child for tort reform, and it did. What people don't realize is the judge reduced the punitive damages to $480,000, and that was because that was our cap, and it ultimately settled for reportedly less than $500,000. But the point is, New Mexico juries are not afraid to impose large penalties on corporations, and that matters here because they did.
Now, let's move over to the tobacco comparison. And the CNBC's coverage explicitly compared this wave of social media litigation to the big tobacco suits in the 1990s. And the parallels are real. Internal documents showing the company knew its products were harmful. Check. Executives ignoring their own safety teams. Check. Public statements that contradict internal knowledge. Check. The tobacco master settlement agreement in 1998 didn't just cost the industry $206 billion. It fundamentally changed how tobacco companies could operate, market, and interact with the public. And that's what New Mexico is going for in phase two of this trial.
Yes, which brings us to why the $375 million is not the story. The story is what happens on May 4th. There's a second phase, and it's a bench trial, no jury. And Judge who?
I think that's going to be Bygide.
Judge Bygide. The state is bringing a public nuisance claim, and the relief they're asking for goes far beyond money. Attorney General Torres went on CNBC Squawk Box the day after the verdict and laid it out. He said they're asking for injunctive relief, mandatory age verification, changes to the recommendation algorithms, restrictions on certain design features, and an independent monitor appointed by the court to oversee compliance, just like the tobacco companies got independent monitors.
Now, this is where I'm going to have to jump in and kind of take over a little bit, because when lawyers and politicians say age verification and algorithm changes, I don't think most people understand what they're actually talking about technically. Now, and Larry, I know you're not really, technology is not really your forte.
Yes, I've told you I predate the telegraph. I was helping design and lay those lines back in the mid-1800s.
All right, well, let me explain what it looks like under the hood. When they say real age verification, they don't mean clicking a checkbox that says, quote unquote, I'm over 13. They mean identity verification, submitting a government-issued ID or biometric analysis, which is a fancy way of saying facial recognition or thumbprint or something like that, to estimate your age. Now, some of the proposals floating around require third-party age verification services that collect and store your identifying documents.
And that would apply to everyone, not just children, right?
That is exactly the point. You can't verify that someone is not a minor without verifying who they are. There's no technical mechanism that checks age without collecting identity. So what you're really building is a system where every single person who wants to use a social media platform has to hand over government ID or submit to biometric scanning. You're building an identity verification checkpoint for the internet.
Now, that's funny.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Funny is a word we could use.
And I would imagine that the data has to be stored somewhere, and then it begs a lot of questions. Who all would have access to it, and could it be marketed? What would they do with it? How would they secure it? And what would they do to stop data breaches, and on and on and on?
You are hitting all of the cylinders there. So it does, and it's a massive, massive, massive honeypot. Are you familiar with that term?
Yes.
Okay. And it isn't theoretical. In September 2025, Discord, where we're actually like broadcasting this to folks right now, and that's a platform used by millions of gamers and other communities, had its third-party customer support provider breached. According to Discord's own disclosure, approximately 70,000 users had their government-issued IDs exposed. These were photos people had submitted specifically for age verification. The hacker group claimed access to over 2 million ID images and 1.5 terabytes of data. The Electronic Frontier Foundation gave Discord their 2025 We Still Told You So Breaches Award for the incident. And here's the kicker. Discord then turned around and announced mandatory age verification for all users starting in 2026, using the same type of infrastructure that just got breached. The EFFF has called age verification mandates a censorship and surveillance nightmare. And they're right.
So the cure might end up being worse than the disease, in my opinion. And everybody that rails against big government, well, it's not the government collecting this, but it's the government mandating that this be collected. And this is going to be funny when everybody's data is breached.
That's right. And I'm saying we need to think. So, like, how could you give access to one group of people without collecting all of it? But we need to think about really carefully about what infrastructure we're building in the name of protecting the chirins. You hear me, Larry? Chirins, not children. Chirins. Got it?
Got it.
All right, because that infrastructure doesn't disappear once it exists. It gets repurposed, and our audience knows better than most that things get repurposed.
That's a fair point. Now, there's another development that came out during the trial that I want to bring up. Midway through the proceedings, Meta announced that it would remove end-to-end encryption from Instagram direct messages. And I don't fully understand the technical implications. What does that mean?
Well, this is one that genuinely scares me, and I need to unpack it because there are layers here. So end-to-end encryption, or E2E, means that when you send a message to someone, only you and the recipient can read it. Not Meta, not the government, not a hacker who intercepts it in transit. The message is encrypted on your device and decrypted on theirs. Nobody in the middle can see the content. And by the way, this is the same encryption technology that protects your banking transactions that everyone uses these days. When you log into your bank's website, when you make a purchase online, that little padlock in your browser is telling you that the connection is encrypted, so nobody can intercept your financial data. It's the same underlying principle. So when we talk about weakening encryption, we're not talking about some niche privacy tool for people with something to hide. We're talking about foundational technology that secures the entire digital economy.
And Meta's removing that from Instagram?
Yes. That's the private messaging aspect of it. They announced during the trial that they would be pulling it. Their spokesperson told CNN that not many people were opting into it, so they're just removing the option. But the timing is conspicuous. This happened in the middle of a trial where one of the state's key arguments was that encrypted messaging made it harder for law enforcement to identify predators. And the state presented evidence that changes Meta made to Facebook Messenger's encryption in 2019 impacted their ability to share information with law enforcement in approximately 7.5 million child abuse reports.
So then
to move along, here's where it gets really uncomfortable, and I need for everyone to follow me on this. The stated justification for moving encryption is that you can't detect CSAM, child sexual abuse material, or grooming behavior, or terrorist communications in messages you can't read. And that's technically true, but the inverse is also true. The only way to scan for that content is to have access to all content, every message, every conversation, every photo, every link, from everyone. If you want to find the needle, you have to surveil the entire haystack, which means that every person who is lawfully communicating, and that's an overwhelming majority of users, is having their conversations monitored by default.
And that's a significant constitutional concern. Now, to be fair, it's not an individual, it's technology monitoring, but then where does that stuff go after it's been monitored by high tech?
True. And it's an enormous concern. And it doesn't stop at the platform level. Once the data exists in a readable form, it can then be collected, stored, analyzed, and shared. You may have heard of the NSA's data center in Utah, and it's in Bluffdale. That facility was built specifically for mass data collection and storage. When unencrypted communications flow through platforms at scale, they become available for government collection, whether through direct request, court orders, or programs we may not even know about yet. We know from the Snowden disclosures that the government's appetite for bulk communications data is functionally limitless.
No.
Now, so let's move over to a little bit of the First Amendment territory. If the government directly or through regulatory pressure on companies can read every digital conversation, that has a chilling effect on speech. And what I want to give a concrete example of is back in 1995. Do you remember the thing called AOL, Larry? Did you ever have an AOL CD?
No, but I'm familiar with it. I heard of AOL.
Okay. And at the time, that was the dominant online platform. We could call, quote unquote, AOL the internet at the time. And what they did was they banned the word on their platform. They banned it. They banned the word breast, and that was part of a content cleanup effort. Now, if you ban the word breast, I understand that you can't, 13-year-olds aren't going around like typing in breast and seeing pictures of boobs, but breast cancer patients could not communicate with each other either. Support groups were disrupted. People had their profiles deleted for using a medical term because a content filter couldn't distinguish between medical discussions and something obscene. And that's what happens when you build blunt instrument content moderation systems. They don't distinguish between a predator and a cancer patient. They just flag the keyword.
And that's one of the things I've been griping about for a long time, is that although tech is wonderful, there's some things it can't distinguish the difference between. And this is a great example then. And you're saying the same logic applies to encryption removal.
Yep. And so once you remove encryption, so you can scan for CSAM all in the auspices of protecting the children, you're scanning everything. This means, Larry, you and your boss, when you have conversations, whether you're talking about finances, you're talking about a case coming up, all that stuff's going to get slurped up. This specifically applies that if you were using Instagram and that messaging platform. And so then the tools that scan for illegal content can be retrained to scan for anything: political speech, religious speech, organizing, dissent, any sort of minority, or, you know, any, what's the word? I don't want to say disenfranchised. I'm thinking of like trans people. Any of their conversations would get slurped up. And I'm no fan of hate groups, Larry, but the KKK, you got Christian white nationalists out there. Those people are repugnant to me personally, but they do have a First Amendment right to communicate and assemble and to organize. That, I think, is settled law, right?
Well, I would agree with you on that. And as distasteful as these people are, you should be willing to defend distasteful speech, because when we start having the speech police, your speech is next.
And if every digital communication is readable by default, and all of that activity is under potential scrutiny, not just because someone got a warrant, not because a judge found probable cause, just because the infrastructure exists and someone decided to look.
Well, since you know the Fourth, the Constitution and all the amendments by heart, can you explain the Fourth Amendment connection for our audience?
Sure. So the Fourth Amendment protects us against unreasonable, not ever, unreasonable search and seizure. You need a warrant supported by probable cause and issued by a judge to tap someone's phone. You need a warrant to open their mail. That's foundational stuff. But when a company removes encryption, they're building a window into every conversation that any government or any hacker or any rogue employee can look through. You don't need a warrant to read what was never locked. And for a nation that prides itself on constitutional protections against unreasonable search and seizures, the collective indifference to this is staggering.
And so you're under the misguided belief that we actually value these things. But for our audience specifically, if you're on the registry, you already live under a degree of government scrutiny that most people can't even fathom. The idea that digital tools you use to communicate might have surveillance baked in by default should concern you and everyone enormously.
And then it gets worse, because there's another angle here that most people aren't talking about, and it ties directly into what the writer Shoshana Zuboff has called surveillance capitalism, and where your personal data is the raw material being extracted, packaged, and sold for profit. There's a multi-billion dollar industry of data brokers whose entire business model is collecting your personal information from apps, websites, location services, purchasing history, public records, and packaging it for sale. And here's the part that should make everyone's blood run cold. The government can simply buy it. No warrant required.
How's that legal?
My understanding is based on something called third-party doctrine. The legal theory is that you've voluntarily shared the data with a third party, which you technically did when you agreed to some app's terms of service that nobody ever reads. You have a diminished expectation of privacy in that data. The Supreme Court narrowed this somewhat in Carpenter versus United States in 2018, and that was a case about cell site location data. But the government has been actively purchasing data from brokers to get around warrant requirements. It's end run around the Fourth Amendment, and it's happening right now.
And how do you connect this back to the Meta decision?
Because every piece of safety, quote-unquote safety infrastructure, that gets ordered by a court, age verification systems, identity databases, activity monitoring, algorithm audits, all of that generates data. You create a huge data footprint as you move about. You go to the grocery store, you go to the car wash, you go to the movie theater, and data flows. You build an age verification system to protect kids, and now there's a database linking government IDs to social media profiles. That data can be subpoenaed, it can be breached, just like we'd had discussed earlier in Discord. It can be sold, it can be purchased by a government agency through a data broker without anyone ever going before a judge. The infrastructure of surveillance capitalism and the infrastructure of child safety are becoming the same infrastructure. And that should terrify everyone.
So the surveillance infrastructure that gets built in the name of child safety becomes a tool for monitoring anyone that the government takes an interest in.
That's it exactly. And this isn't conspiracy talk. This is the documented observable pattern. We saw it with the Patriot Act. We saw it with the FISA courts. Broad surveillance powers get authorized for one stated purpose, and then they quietly expand every single time.
No. No, I wouldn't. I can't believe that. The big people that pushed the Patriot Act and all it's been used for since then, but for those impacted by the registry, you're already in a category the government has decided warrants extra monitoring. And any expansion of digital surveillance tools hits you first and hardest.
Right. And I want to bring in some data here because the phrase, quote unquote, protect the children gets used as though children are being snatched off the streets by strangers in epidemic numbers. Now let's look at what the actual numbers say. According to the FBI's Law Enforcement Bulletin, using NCMEC's data, and that's NCMEC, approximately 200,000 children per year are abducted by family members. An additional 58,000 by non-family members, primarily people with a known relationship to the child. The number of what the FBI calls quote-unquote stereotypical kidnappings, where a stranger abducts a child with the intent to keep, ransom, or kill, is approximately 115 per year nationwide. 115 out of roughly 72 million children in the United States. That's less than one in a million. Now, to be fair on that, if it's your child, obviously one is too many, and I'm not trying to discount that. However, we're building this entire infrastructure around that tiny, minuscule number by comparison.
Would it qualify as the imaginary boogeyman that you hear me talk about?
I believe that would qualify as the imaginary boogeyman.
So the danger is overwhelming from people the child already knows and associates with.
Yes, the danger is already in the house. NCMEC's own 2024 data shows that out of the roughly 29,500 missing children cases they assisted with, 91% were endangered runaways. Non-family abductions were approximately 1% of cases. And the recovery rate, according to NCMEC's former president, more than 99% of children reported missing in recent years have come home alive. The FBI's CARD team data show that in 70% of child abduction cases, the abductor had a known relationship with the child. Registered PFRs were the abductor in 1 to 2% of cases.
1 to 2%.
1 to 2%. And yet, the entire surveillance apparatus being proposed, age verification, encryption removal, algorithm monitoring, government-appointed overseas, is being justified by the specter of stranger danger. The data does not support the narrative. The narrative supports the infrastructure, and our audience understands that distinction better than almost anyone else.
Is that right?
I think so. So maybe they would tell us otherwise.
Well, I do want to be clear about something. The state of New Mexico presented a strong case. The jury found Meta liable on every count in about a day. The evidence of internal knowledge and willful inaction was compelling. Former Meta Vice President Brian Boland testified per CNN's trial coverage that he absolutely did not believe that safety was a priority. And to Zuckerberg and Sandberg, and I don't know who Sandberg is, but I think I know who Zuckerberg is.
Sheryl Sandberg. She was the CIO, CTO, whatever. She was like the right-hand, quote-unquote, right-hand man of Zuckerberg for a long time.
But the undercover accounts getting flooded with predatory content is indefensible. There's at least some evidence of a problem if every child, every 13-year-old profile is being hit on by an adult in alarming numbers.
Sure, there absolutely is. But the question our audience needs to be asking is not, should something be done? The answer is obviously a yes. The question is, what is being done and who else does it affect? Because when A.G. Torres walks into that courtroom on May 4th and asks Judge Bachide for mandatory age verification, algorithm oversight, and independent court-appointed monitor, that's not just about Meta. That's a template. Just like the tobacco master settlement agreement became a template. And remember, over 40 state attorneys general have similar suits pending against Meta. If New Mexico gets a favorable order on the public nuisance claim, you will see that framework replicated nationwide.
And protect the children is a phrase that, as our listeners know, gets attached to legislation and court orders that accomplish far more than their stated purpose.
It's a skeleton key. It opens every door. Say that you're trying to protect the children, you can do whatever you want. Nobody can vote against it. Just like anything with PFR, if the legislator says, "Oh, I voted down against something that made life worse for PFRs," they're going to get outed in the next election. So nobody can argue against it in public without getting destroyed. And then the people who wield it, they know that.
So what should we be watching? What should people be watching for?
May 4th is when the bench trial happens. The money is a sideshow, really. Watch what Judge Bachide orders in terms of injunctive relief. Watch whether he mandates identity-based verification. Watch whether the independent monitor framework becomes a model other states adopt. And encrypt everything you can while you still can. Use Signal for messaging. Use a VPN. Use strong passwords and two-factor authentication. Read the privacy policies. Opt out of data collection wherever you can, because the walls are closing in on digital privacy, and they're closing in fastest on the people who can least afford to lose it. And that's our people. That's our audience.
Well said. The full complaint is available on the New Mexico Attorney General's website at nmag.gov, and the New Mexico courts have been posting the admitted trial exhibits at nmcourts.gov.
And we'll drop links to the complaint, the statute, and the key news coverage in the show notes. Now, all right. What do you think? Anything else you want to cover on that one?
Well, I really appreciate all the laborious work. I know you've worked on this for hours, putting this
hours
together.
It wasn't like 10 minutes. All right.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Then we shall venture over, we'll jaunt over to North Carolina's Sheriff Barney Fife. And you have a case you want to talk about, and it's from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Now, while I was cutting the grass today, I thoroughly reviewed the facts, and I have a simple question to begin with. This decision came down in April of 2024, so like 2 years ago? Why did you wait so long?
Because I didn't know about it until this week.
You're telling me that despite FYP's research staff and the many tools you have, that you didn't know about this important case?
That's what I'm telling you. We should probably fire the entire research staff.
I think that sounds right. So the name of the case is Thurston versus Fry. So Kevin Fry and Lee Buchanan appealed the district court's denial of their motion for summary judgment. Oh, your favorite. They argued that they are entitled to qualified immunity because their arrest of David Thurston did not violate his Fourth Amendment rights. Tell us about Thurston.
Well, he's a fine gentleman. In 1992, Thurston pleaded guilty to 2 counts of sexually assaulting minors in Montana. Fast forward, in 2015, Thurston moved to Avery County, North Carolina. Fry served as sheriff, and Buchanan was the deputy in charge of PFR registration. So remember, Sheriff Fry and Deputy Buchanan as we go through this case.
All right. So on August 9th, 2016, Thurston informed Sheriff Fry that he had been invited to his nephew's wedding, which was scheduled for September 17th in Spokane, Washington. But Thurston's biannual verification was due to be sent out around that same time. Mindful of these obligations, Thurston sought Sheriff Fry's advice on how to comply with the law and asked for his permission to attend the wedding. After they exchanged text, Sheriff Fry told Thurston on August 11th that he could go because the sheriff's office was working on it. All Thurston needed to do, Sheriff Fry explained, was email a copy of Thurston's Washington visitor registration form within 10 days of his arrival. What is a visitor registration form?
Well, Sheriff Fry told him that he needed to register while he was in Washington because he's going to be there for an extended period of time.
I see. So Thurston left North Carolina that same day, yet on his way to Spokane, Sheriff Fry reached out again asking Thurston for the address of where he would be staying. Thurston provided his address and later arrived in Washington on August 21st. Once there, he registered as a visitor and emailed the registration to Sheriff Fry as instructed. In all, Thurston stayed for over a month, interspersed with excursions to Seattle to visit a friend.
It gets even funnier. On September 9th, while Thurston was away, the sheriff's office mailed his verification form. Thurston's sister, who lived with him in North Carolina, told him about the form, prompting him to contact Sheriff Fry for guidance. But Sheriff Fry never responded, so Thurston decided to let it die, given their prior interactions regarding this.
Now, I'm guessing the sheriff did not let it die?
You guessed correctly. They did not. Deputy Buchanan began investigating Thurston. Three times after Thurston's September 12th verification deadline, Deputy Buchanan stopped by Thurston's residence. Now remember, the sheriff himself told him he'd go on this trip, but they stopped by, and of course he wasn't there.
So then what happens next?
On October 6th, Spokane County Sheriff's Office phoned Thurston informing him that Deputy Buchanan was looking for him and was considering getting U.S. Marshals involved. Concerned, as anybody would be in their right mind, Thurston contacted Deputy Buchanan, who said his prolonged absence was causing problems back home. Deputy Buchanan then erroneously told Thurston that it was illegal for him to be out of the state for more than 30 days. Yet in the same breath, he also said that he had spoken with Sheriff Fry and decided as long as Thurston was back in North Carolina by October 19th, there would be no problem. Thurston met the deadline and returned to North Carolina on October 19th.
It's interesting that despite all the documented communication, Deputy Buchanan discussed potential criminal liability with an assistant district attorney. The ADA recommended that they pursue charges against Thurston. And then on October 19th, despite knowing that he and Sheriff Fry had given Thurston until that day to return to the state, Deputy Buchanan obtained a warrant from a local magistrate.
Now, I'm going to hold out hope. Can you at least admit that this is funny?
You're a sick individual if you think that this is funny. What happened next?
You're hopeless. You're never going to...
No. You can just hang that up. You could put the funniest comedian on stage, and I'm not going to laugh.
So, on October 21st, Thurston went to the Avery County Sheriff's Office to deliver his now-completed verification form. He was greeted with an arrest. They alleged three different criminal violations from September 19th, October 18th. One, being out of state for 30 plus days. Two, willfully failing to return his verification form. Remember, he returned it. And three, willfully failing to report in person to the sheriff's office. Now remember, he showed up there. To me, this is hilarious because the records created by Thurston clearly show that basically all this is untrue.
Right. So then 1 year later, Thurston sued the Avery County Sheriff's Office, Sheriff Fry, and Deputy Buchanan, alleging, among other things, violation of Thurston's Fourth Amendment rights. The officers asserted defense of qualified immunity and moved for summary judgment. What did the district court do?
The district court denied their motion for summary judgment, and this appeal followed.
So then Sheriff Fry and Deputy Buchanan maintained on appeal that they are entitled to qualified immunity. They first argued that they did not violate Thurston's Fourth Amendment rights because they had probable cause to seek his arrest. Further, they argued that even if the arrest lacked probable cause, it did not violate clearly established law because it was supported by a warrant.
Well, that last sentence is just shy. I should say it is hilarious. They said because it was supported by a warrant. The warrant was issued as a result of the request of their request based on misleading information that they provided to the magistrate judge.
Now, would there be a situation where the argument that the arrest was based on a warrant be viable?
Yes, there would be. There would be many warrants that law enforcement officers would encounter where they didn't seek the warrants and they're merely acting on what's in. So an agency that is acting on information and they arrest someone that's a result of an open warrant that simply appears in an NCIC database, they cannot be deemed at fault if the warrant turns out it shouldn't have been issued. But the problem for these people in Barney Fife's sheriff's office is that the warrant would not have even existed but for their misleading and malicious actions. That's the difference.
Sounds like you're saying that the police lie.
No.
Now, can we dig into the qualified immunity a bit? Can you explain what it is and how it is applied?
Well, it's kind of controversial, but qualified immunity protects government officials from claims of statutory unconstitutional violations when they reasonably mistook and thought their actions were legal, and when they mistook the legality of their actions. But the court stated, to determine whether Sheriff Fry and Deputy Buchanan are entitled to qualified immunity, we must first answer two questions with a split burden of proof. First, has Thurston established that when viewing the evidence most favorably to him, the officers violated his constitutional rights? If so, then have the officers shown that the asserted rights were not clearly established? Because, see, the burden shifts when he gets past prong one. They have to show that those rights were not clearly established once he shows that it's been a constitutional violation. If those rights were not clearly established at the time that they made their good faith mistake, then they get qualified immunity.
Thurston's arrest warrant identifies three crimes: failing to register that he would be out of state for 30 days, purportedly in violation of North Carolina's general statute, and that's 14-208.11. And number two, willfully and feloniously failing to return the form verifying his address to the sheriff's office in the time allotted, in violation of subsection 14-208.11, blah, 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 blah. And then finally, number three, willfully and feloniously failing to report in person to the sheriff's office in violation of 14-208.11, blah, 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 blah.
Yes, and it's very interesting that the parties agreed that the officers lacked probable cause for the first non-existent offense. See, the first one, that you can't be out of state for more than 30 days, was totally pulled out of their recti.
Okay.
Statute books. So the parties, even the people defending the sheriffs, agreed that was non-existent. But they asserted that there was probable cause for the two other offenses. Thurston, on the other hand, argued that these crimes carry a mens rea requirement, which is knowledge or an element of willfulness. And according to him, at the time they sought the warrant, the officers lacked probable cause to believe that he was acting willfully, because that's in the North Carolina statute about PFR registration. It has to be a willful noncompliance.
The court stated that Deputy Buchanan and Sheriff Fry therefore needed some reason to believe that Thurston either purposefully violated the law or acted with some other improper purpose. How did that go?
Not very well, because the district court's order and findings foreclosed any argument that they believe this. Viewing the evidence in light most favorable to Thurston, the district court accepted that both defendants definitely knew that Thurston was eager to comply with the law. That's why keeping that digital footprint, the information, was so helpful. And the district court accepted that officers knew that Sheriff Fry gave Thurston permission to travel and that Thurston followed every instruction the sheriff's office gave him. And so concluding, the district court not only accepted these facts alleged about Thurston's actions, but also accepted that the officers had concluded based on those actions that Thurston was eager to comply with the law.
So who bears the burden of proof then?
Well, again, once the challenger proves that a constitutional violation did occur, and if the officers want their qualified immunity, the burden is on them. In this case, the officers did not prove that Thurston's arrest was not contrary to clearly established law. The court stated, "We thus conclude that the officers have failed to carry their burden to show that they're entitled to summary judgment. Though they acted pursuant to a warrant, no reasonable officer would have sought the warrant here," which is what I've been saying. "The district court therefore correctly denied their assertions of qualified immunity."
The court noted that qualified immunity is controversial and criticized, but in it is binding, and it provides a powerful defense for officers who, while performing the critical service they provide to society, make reasonable mistakes in complying with the law, and warrants serve a similar purpose.
And they went on to say, "We recognize that the magistrate judge is more qualified than a police officer to make a probable cause determination. Thus, a magistrate's approval of a warrant application in the average case will be the clearest indication of the officer's objective reasonableness." And they concluded with clearest should not be confused with absolute. "In a narrow set of cases where no reasonable officer would have sought the warrant, we cannot treat its issuance as evidence of objective reasonableness." I think this is hilarious. I know you're not going to laugh, but I think it is.
Well, tell me something. We didn't really talk about any kind of compensation. How did that come out in the end here for whoever Thurston, he prevailed, right? Did they win? Did they win money?
He didn't win money, but his legal fees were paid, awarded something to the tune of just over $100,000 of legal fees to a relatively small county. And I'm hoping that that gets their attention, because money usually gets attention in a county of 17,000. $100,000 is not just a rounding error.
Does that trickle downhill and do the officers get fired? Do they get a bill?
No, it'd be great if they did, but no, there'll be no consequences for that. If officers were rated in some category of civil rights violations and then it resulted in a no hire.
Yeah.
But they don't do that. So they'll just move on with life as if nothing happened, because it's not their money. It'll come out of however North Carolina settles these cases. In New Mexico, it come out of the state's funds. But in many, like Georgia, the county, you know, that suit we brought against Butts County over the Halloween signs, yep, the county had to cough that up.
And then they could run around and post on social media that because of this jerk person, PFR on the registry, we don't have $100,000, therefore we can't do road improvements.
That's what they'll say.
And that's why we need to make these laws tougher so that we can win, right?
That's right. You got it.
Okay, I got it all figured out. This is the last episode because we have figured it out.
Yep, don't need me anymore.
Anything else you want to cover before we head on out?
No, I think this was the best episode we've done in 2026.
It could be. Well, that doesn't really leave us a lot. We're only a quarter of the way through. Head over to registrymatters.co for show notes and links everywhere you need to go. You can also, of course, head over to FYP Education for transcripts and blog posts, and that's also where the shop is at fypeducation.org/shop. You can email me over at registrymatterscast@gmail.com, and I will forward that over to the Larianator. And then also leave a voicemail message at 747-227-4477. And of course, please, 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 please head over to patreon.com/registrymatters to show your support for the podcast. I hope you have a fantabulous weekend, Larry, and stay out of trouble. And don't call me at 5 in the morning because I won't answer.
All right, I'll wait till 6.
Please. Have a great night, everybody. Thanks for coming around, and we will talk to you very soon. Take care.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.